You thought I was crazy, didn't you?
No. Honestly,
you all thought I was crazy at the university. Now, I'm going to show you just how crazy I am. Igor! Bring in the monster.
Why, it's a giant bagel.
Yes, but feel the crust.
It's breathing.
Yes.
It's alive.
Yes. Igor, bring in the other monster.
Looks like it can't be. A grossly large, round, heaving matzo ball.
Now for the pièce de résistance. Igor, place the matzo ball in the center of the bagel.
My God! They're... I can't bring myself to say it!
Yes! The matzo ball is joining with the bagel in sexual congress!
No!
Yes! They're copulating!
You fiend! But what happens when you cross a matzo ball with a bagel?
I don't know, but I should make a fortune in the Catskill.
National Public Radio presents a production of the Hollywood Theater of the Year, 2000X. A radio series devoted to stories of the next millennia. Now, here is your host, award-winning writer and critic, Harlan Ellison.
The scene, the front porch of a modest small-town house. The time, beyond the year 2000.
Ma'am.
Hmm?
Excuse me, ma'am.
There. Oh, my. Is it Halloween already? I'm totally unprepared. Oh, gee. Let me go in and see what kind of goodies I can rustle up.
No, ma'am. Please don't bother. I'm not a kid in a costume. I'm a real alien from outer space.
Oh.
And I'm taking a survey.
Alien?
Would you mind answering a few questions for me?
A survey? Well, gee, no. I'd be delighted. Come on in now.
No, come on in, ma'am. We can do it right here on your front porch.
Really? Oh, but let me make you a little tea or offer you a piece of homemade pie.
Don't bother. Thanks. But stay right. Don't bother yourself. You don't have to get up. We space aliens don't indulge.
Oh, I didn't know that. Mm. But you're sure now? It's awfully good pie.
Sure,
I just made
sure,
it this
thanks.
Morning. All right. Well, then, you wouldn't mind if I just keep knitting here while we're talking?
Oh, go right ahead.
Thank you.
Won't take long.
Oh, well, then. Now, what was it you wanted to ask me?
Well, let's see now. Could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Me?
Your core belief system and how you implement that system.
Oh, Nelly. Gee.
Speak right here up into this erpetuffle here.
Like this? Is this all right?
You don't have to shout. Oh. It'll pick you up fine, but you're just fine now.
All right.
Just go right ahead and...
I just talk in my normal voice.
Right, then.
All right.
Start with your name.
Oh, sure. This is exciting. My name is Fanny Billingsgate. I'm 87 years old, last month. I am a widow, and I've lived in Springfield, here, right in this town, all my life. I have four children, all living, thank the Lord, 8 grandchildren, and 2 lovely great-grandchildren, 1 on the way. My late husband, God love him, Roger, and I also adopted and raised a total of 42 orphans, many of whom still correspond with me. Social Security doesn't provide enough for me to continue that, but I do volunteer at the Red Cross, over at the library, and, the VA hospital, too. Can't forget that one. You see, I believe that God put us on this earth to help one another. That's what I believe. Whether it's white, black, yellow, or brown. Oh, or green. We are all God's children. That's what I believe. Made in His image and deserving of care and compassion. God always provided for Roger and me, and we have always shared His bounty and tried in our small way to make the world a better place to live. Let's see what else. Well, I still keep up with current events. I vote every election without fail, rain or shine. I write my congressman regularly. And I participate in community activities as much as I can, of course. Oh, naturally, I go to church every Sunday. I support the Symphony and Art Museum. I give to the United Way. Belong to the Neighborhood Watch. I buy Christmas seals. I love to read. Oh, I read voraciously, even though my eyes aren't what they used to be. I love to work out over at the center twice a week. Maintain a vegetarian diet. Of course, I never drink nor smoke. I am an organ donor. I subscribe to Consumers Reports. Support my local public radio station. Brush and floss after every meal.
Ma'am, thank you. I think that's all I need.
Oh, well. Could you tell me, what is this survey for?
Oh. Well, we space aliens monitor the human race periodically.
You do?
Oh, yes. With your advancing technology, you will soon be joining the universal community of intelligent life. Oh. So we come now and then to check out if you are worthy. Because we wouldn't want humanity's taste for war and strife to spread.
No, we wouldn't want that.
No. But so long as we are able to find good folk like you on this planet, we refrain from destroying it.
Oh, my word.
So, Mrs. Billingsgate?
Yes.
Congratulations.
What?
You have saved your species from extermination.
Oh, that's nice.
Good day now, ma'am.
Drive carefully. Toodaloo. He's gone.
Okay, people. That's a wrap. We've saved the Earth. We can go home now.
Where the heck is my cell phone? I gotta call my agent.
Good work, Mary.
You have just heard Janet Carroll and Ira Burton in The Survey by Yuri Rasovsky. We have been receiving one or two, a few, well, more than just a few, it's a bunch as well. Damn it, it's a clutch of complaints from some of you who have nothing better to do with your time than complain that my supporting comments for these wonderful tales have not been, well, serious enough for your taste. That I've been too joyful, having too much fun, I'm too filled with puckishness, and I'm obviously enjoying myself too much, So the management of the Hollywood Theater of the Ear, here in our palatial Art Deco and Byzantine studios, set high above the glittering panoply of the City of Angels, they have laid down the law. There will be no more smart-aleck remarks on my part. Serious is what they want. Deadly serious, yes. Rodomontade fit for existence beside the likes of, well, for instance, our offering this time, A Dream of Armageddon by H.G. Wells. Serious is what they want. Serious is what I'll give you. And so, I will eschew such tomfoolery as pointing out that I like Herbert George Wells mainly because he enjoyed playing with military miniatures the same as I do, that he was a great humanitarian and student of human nature, a pragmatist at heart, the father of modern science fiction, who nonetheless believed in seances, spirit manifestations, and the existence of fairies at the bottom of the garden. I will not point out that he had a splendid mustache. I will merely vouchsafe the opinion that our radio play this time, A Dream of Armageddon, is a serious piece. It is a very serious piece, written in 1903, and it is set in the same disturbing world Wells described in When the Sleeper Wakes. Now, we're talking serious stuff here. And so, without a giggle, I seriously commend to your listening attention Mr. H.G. Wells' serious story, A Dream of Armageddon.
Excuse me, you're reading about dreams.
I beg your pardon?
Your book, Fortnum Roscoe's Dream States. It's about dreams?
Obviously.
Yes. But they tell you nothing. They don't know. There are dreams and dreams. I suppose, do you ever dream?
I mean, vividly. I dream very little. I doubt if I have three vivid dreams in a year.
Ah. Your dreams don't mix with your memories. You don't find yourself in doubt. Did this happen or did it not?
Hardly ever, except for just a momentary hesitation now and then. I suppose few people do.
Does he say...
Says it happens at times and gives the usual explanation about intensity of impression and the like to account for its not happening as a rule. I suppose you know something of these theories?
Very little, very little. Except that they are wrong. Isn't there something called consecutive dreaming that goes on night after night?
I believe there is. There are cases given in most books on mental trouble.
Huh? Mental trouble, yes. Yes, I dare say there are. It's the right place for them. But what I mean is that sort of thing always dreaming? Is it? Is it dreaming, or is it something else? Mightn't it be something else? I'm not just arguing about a matter of opinion. The thing's killing me.
Dreams?
If you call them dreams. Night after night. Vivid, so vivid. This, all this scenery passing by the window as we ride, it all seems unreal in comparison. I can scarcely remember who I am, what business I'm on. Even now.
The dream is always the same, do you mean?
No, it's over.
You mean?
I died.
Died?
Smashed and killed. And now, so much of me as that dream was, is dead. Dead forever. I dreamt I was another man, you know. Living in a different part of the world, and in a different time. I dreamt that, night after night. Night after night, I woke into that other life. Fresh scenes and fresh happenings. Until I came upon the last.
When you died?
When I died.
And since then?
No, thank God. That was the end of the dream.
Living in a different time. Do you mean in some different age?
Yes.
Past?
No, to come. To come.
The year 3000, for example?
Well, I don't know what year it was. I did when I was asleep. When I was dreaming, that is. But not now. Not now that I am awake. There's a lot of things I've forgotten since I woke out of these dreams. Though I knew them at the time when I was... Well, I suppose it was dreaming. They called the year differently from our way of calling the year. What did they call it? No, I forget.
It began
It was vivid from the first. I seemed to wake up in it suddenly. And it's curious that in these dreams I am speaking of, I never remembered this life I am living now. It seemed as if the dream life was enough while it lasted. Perhaps. But I will tell you how I find myself when I do my best to recall it all. I don't remember anything clearly until I found myself sitting in a sort of loggia, looking out over the sea. I'd been dozing, and suddenly I woke up, fresh and vivid, not a bit dreamlike, because the girl had stopped fanning me.
The girl?
Yes, the girl. You must not interrupt or you'll put me out. You won't think I'm mad.
No. You've been dreaming. Tell me your dream.
I woke up, I said, because the girl had stopped fanning me. I wasn't surprised to find myself there or anything of that sort, you understand. I didn't feel I'd fallen into it suddenly. I simply took it up at that point. Whatever memory I had of this life, this 19th century life, faded as I woke. Vanished. Like a dream. I knew all about myself. Knew that my name was no longer Cooper, but Hedden. And all about my position in the world. I've forgotten a lot since I woke. There's a want of connection, but it was all quite clear and matter of fact then. This seems bosh to you?
No. Go on. Tell me what this loggia was like.
It wasn't really a loggia. I don't know what to call it. It faced south. It was small. It was all in shadow, except the semicircle above the balcony that showed the sky and sea, and the corner where the girl stood. I was on a couch. It was a metal couch with light striped cushions. And the girl was leaning over the balcony with her back to me. The light of the sunrise fell on her ear and cheek. A pretty white neck, and the little curls that nestled there, and her white shoulder were in the sun, and all the grace of her body was in the cool blue shadow. She was dressed, how can I describe it? It was easy and flowing, and altogether there she stood, so that it came to me how beautiful and desirable she was. As though I'd never seen her before. And when at last I sighed and raised myself upon my arm, she turned her face to me. I have lived 53 years in this world. I have had mother, sisters, friends, wife, and daughters. All their faces, the play of their faces, I know. But the face of this girl, it is much more real to me. I can bring it back into memory so that I see it again. I could draw it. Or paint it. And after all, the face of a dream. A face of a dream. She was beautiful. You see, I had thrown up my plans and ambitions, thrown up all I had ever worked for or desired for her sake. I had been a master man away there in the north. I had influence, property, and a great reputation. But none of it had seemed worth having beside her. I had come to the place, this city of sunny pleasures, with her, and left all those things to wreck and ruin, just to save a remnant at least of my life. While I had been in love with her before I knew that she had any care for me, before I had imagined that she would dare, that we should dare, all my life had seemed vain and hollow. Dust and ashes. It was dust and ashes. Night after night, and through the long days I had longed and desired, my soul had beaten against the thing forbidden. But it is impossible for one man to tell another just these things. It's emotion. It's a tint. A light that comes and goes. Only while it's there, everything changes. Everything. The thing is, I came away and left them in their crisis to do what they could.
Left whom?
The people up in the north there. You see, well, in this dream, anyhow, I had been a big man, the sort of man other men come to trust in, to group themselves about. Millions of men who had never seen me were ready to do things and risk things because of their confidence in me. I had been playing that game for years, that big, laborious game, that vague, monstrous, political game, amid intrigues and betrayals, speech and agitation. It was a vast, weltering world, and at last I had a sort of leadership against the gang. You know, it was called the gang, a sort of compromise of scoundrelly projects and base ambitions and vast public emotional stupidities and catchwords. The gang that kept the world noisy and blind year by year. And all the while that it was drifting towards infinite disaster. But I can't expect you to understand the shades and complications of the year something or other ahead. I had it all down to the smallest of details in my dream. I suppose I had been dreaming of it before I awoke in the loggia, and the fading outline of some queer new development I had imagined still hung about me as I rubbed my eyes. It was some grubby affair that made me thank God for the sunlight. I sat up on the couch and remained looking at the woman and rejoicing that I had come away out of all that tumult and folly and violence before it was too late. After all, I thought, this is life, love and beauty, desire and delight. Are they not worth all those dismal struggles for vague, gigantic ends? But I blamed myself for having ever sought to be a leader, when I might have given my days to love. But then, thought I, if I had not spent my early days sternly and austerely, I might have wasted myself upon vain and worthless women. And at the thought, all my being went out in love and tenderness to my dear mistress, my dear lady, who had come at last and compelled me by her invincible charm for me, to lay that life aside. You are worth it, I said, speaking without intending her to hear. You are worth it, my dearest one, worth pride and praise and all things. Love, to have you is worth them all together. And at the murmur of my voice, she turned about. Come and see, she cried. I can hear her now. Come
and see the sunrise upon Monte Solaro.
Oh, how can I describe to you the scene we had before us? We were at Capri.
I have been there. I've clambered up Monte Solaro and drunk Vero Capri. Muddy stuff like cider at the summit.
Ah, then perhaps you can tell me. You will know if this was indeed Capri. For in this life, I have never been there. Let me describe it. We were in a little room, one of a vast multitude of little rooms, very cool and sunny, hollowed out of the limestone of a sort of cape very high above the sea. The whole island, you know, was one enormous hotel, complex beyond explaining. And on the other side, there were miles of floating hotels and huge floating stages to which the flying machines came.
Flying machines?
They called it a pleasure city. Of course, there was none of that in your time. Rather, I should say, is none of that now. Of course. Now. Yes. Well, this room of ours was at the extremity of the cape, so that one could see east and west. Eastward was a great cliff, 1,000 feet high perhaps, coldly grey, except for one bright edge of gold. And beyond it, the Isle of the Sirens, and a falling coast that faded and passed into the hot sunrise. And when one turned to the west, distinct and near was a little bay, a little beach still in shadow. And out of that shadow rose Solara, straight and tall, flushed and golden crested, like a beauty throned. And the white moon was floating behind her in the sky. And before us, from east to west, stretched the many-tinted sea, all dotted with little sailing boats. And just below us was a rock with an arch worn through it.
I knew the rock. I was nearly drowned there. It is called the Faraglione.
I Faraglione? Yes. Yes, she called it that. There was some story, but that... No, I forget that story. Well, this is the first thing I remember, the first dream I had. That little shaded room and the beautiful air and sky, and that dear lady of mine with her shining arms and her graceful robe, and how we sat and talked in half whispers to one another. We talked in whispers not because there was anyone to hear, but because there was still such a freshness of mind between us that our thoughts were a little frightened, I think, to find themselves at last in words. And so they went softly. Presently we were hungry, and we went from our apartment, going by a strange passage with a moving floor, until we came to the great breakfast room. There was a fountain and music. A pleasant and joyful place it was, with its sunlight and splashing. And we sat and ate and smiled at one another. And I would not heed a man who was watching me from a table nearby. And afterwards, we went on to the dancing hall. But I cannot describe that hall. The place was enormous, larger than any building you have ever seen. And in one place, there was the old gate of Capri, caught into the wall of a gallery high overhead. Light girders, stems, and threads of gold burst from the pillars like fountains, streamed like an aurora across the roof, and interlaced like conjuring tricks. All about the great circle for the dancers, there were beautiful figures, strange dragons, and intricate and wonderful grotesques, bearing lights. The place was inundated with artificial light. Shame for newborn day. And as we went through the throng, the people turned about and looked at us.
Look, it is he, Hedon.
Hedon, yes. And that is she for whom he gave up all his power in the north and brought shame upon himself.
Is any woman worth such a dishonor?
Oh, that woman, most assuredly.
Thousands of beautiful people swarmed about the hall, crowded the galleries, sat in a myriad recesses. They were dressed in splendid colors and crowned with flowers. Thousands danced about the great circle beneath the white images of the ancient gods. And glorious processions of youths, maidens came and went. And then, it was when we had done dancing, a man came to speak to me. He was a lean, resolute man, very soberly clad for that place. And already I had noticed his face watching me in the breakfasting hall. And afterwards, as we went along the passage, I had avoided his eye. But now, as we sat in a little alcove, smiling at the pleasure of all the people who went to and fro across the shining floor, he came and touched me and spoke to me so that I was forced to listen.
Pardon me, but I should like a word with you alone.
No, I have no secrets from this lady. What do you want to tell me?
Well, it's just a trivial matter, or at least a dry matter for a lady to hear.
Perhaps for me to hear.
If you insist, have you heard of a great and avenging declaration that Evesham has made?
Evesham? Yes, the man next to myself in the leadership of that great party in the north. He was a forcible, hard, and tactless man. And only I had been able to control and soften him. It was on his account, even more than my own, I think, that the others had been so dismayed at my retreat. So this question about what he had done reawakened my old interest in the life I had put aside just for a moment. I said, I've taken no heed of any news for many days. What has Evesham been saying?
He's making wild and reckless threats. He speaks of resorting to arms if his demands are not met. Only you have ever managed to control it. Your former colleagues do not know what to do. We need you. How are we to deal with the situation?
My old habits of scheming and organizing reasserted themselves. I could even see myself suddenly returning to the North and all the dramatic effect of it. All that this man said witnessed to the disorder of the party, indeed, but not to its damage. I should go back stronger than I had come. And then... then I thought of my lady. You see, how can I tell you? There were certain peculiarities of our relationship. As things are, I need not tell you about that. Which would render her presence with me impossible. I should have had to leave her. Indeed, I should have had to renounce her clearly and openly if I was to do all that I could do in the North. And the man knew that, even as he talked to her and me, knew it as well as she did, that my steps to duty were first separation, then abandonment. At the touch of that thought, my dream of a return was shattered. I turned on the man suddenly as he was imagining his eloquence was gaining ground with me. Do you think I'm coquetting with your people in coming here?
No.
Then why can't you leave me alone? I've done with these things. I have ceased to be anything but a private man.
Yes, but have you thought? This talk of war, these reckless challenges, these wild aggressions...
No, I won't hear you. I took count of all those things, I weighed them, and I've come away.
Then it's war.
And then he turned slowly from me and walked away. I stood caught in the whirl of thoughts his appeal had set going.
Dear, but if they have need of you...
They want me only to do the thing they dare not do themselves. If they distrust Evesham, they must settle with him themselves.
But war...
I sat down beside her. I put an arm behind her and took her hand in mine. I set myself to drive that doubt away. I set myself to fill her mind with pleasant things again. I lied to her. And in lying to her, I lied also to myself. And she was only too ready to believe me. Only too ready to forget.
In a moment, Beyond 2000 will return with the conclusion of a dream...
...programs in the 2000 Ellison.
And now, Act 2 of H.G. Wells' A Dream of Armageddon.
You know, that is not quite the way I think about affairs, about my real affairs. I am a solicitor, you know, with a point of view. The vision was so real, you must understand, so utterly unlike a dream, that I kept perpetually recalling little irrelevant details. Even the ornament of a book cover that lay on my wife's sewing machine in the breakfast room, recalled with the utmost vividness the gilt line that ran about the seat in the alcove where I had talked with the messenger from my deserted party. Have you ever heard of a dream that had a quality like that?
Like,
It was so that afterwards you remembered little details you'd forgotten.
Never. That is what you never seem to do with dreams.
No, but that is just what I did. I am a solicitor, you must understand, in Liverpool. And I could not help wondering about the clients and business people I found myself talking to in my office. What would they think if I told them suddenly I was in love with a girl who would be born a couple of hundred years or so hence and worried about the politics of my great-great-great-grandchildren? I was chiefly busy that day negotiating a 99-year building lease. It was a private builder in a hurry, and we wanted to tie him in every possible way. I had an interview with him, and he showed a certain want of temper that sent me to bed still irritated. That night I had no dream. Nor did I dream the next night, at least to remember. Something of that intense reality of conviction vanished. I began to feel sure it was a dream. And then it came again. When the dream came again, nearly 4 days later, it was very different. I think it's certain that 4 days had also elapsed in the dream. Many things had happened in the north, and the shadow of them was back again between us. And this time it was not so easily dispelled. I began, I know, thinking, why, in spite of all, should I go back? Go back for all the rest of my days to toil and stress, insults and perpetual dissatisfaction, simply to save hundreds of millions of common people, whom I did not love, whom too often I could do no other than despise, save them from the stress and anguish of war and infinite misrule. And after all, I might fail. They all sought their own narrow ends. And why shouldn't I? Why shouldn't I also live as a man?
Patton, dearest.
I found myself awake and walking. We had come out above the pleasure city. We were near the summit of Monte Solaro and looking towards the bay. It was the late afternoon, very clear. Far away to the left, Ischia hung in a golden haze between sea and sky, and Naples was coldly white against the hills, and before us was Vesuvius, with a tall and slender streamer feathering at last towards the south, and the ruins of Torre dell'Annunziata and Castellammare, glittering and near. All across the bay beyond Sorrento were the floating palaces of the pleasure city, moored and chained. And northward were the broad floating stages that received the airplanes. Airplanes fell out of the sky every afternoon, each bringing its thousands of pleasure seekers from the uttermost parts of the earth to Capri and its delights. All these things, I say, stretched below. But we noticed them only incidentally because of an unusual sight that evening had to show. 5 war airplanes that had long slumbered useless in the distant arsenals of the Rhine mouth were maneuvering now in the eastward sky. Evesham had astonished the world by producing them and others and sending them to circle here and there. It was the threat material in the great game of bluff he was playing, and it had taken even me by surprise. He was one of those incredibly stupid, energetic people who seem sent by heaven to create disasters. His energy, to the first glance, seemed so wonderfully like capacity. But he had no imagination, no invention, only a stupid, vast, driving force of will and a mad faith in his stupid, idiot luck to pull him through. I remember how we stood out upon the headland, watching the squadron circling far away, and how I weighed the full meaning of the sight, seeing clearly the way things must go.
It isn't too late, you know.
I know.
You can still go back.
I do not wish to go back.
The people of the North will follow you.
Perhaps, but only if in one thing I respect their moral standards. And you know what that means.
The East and South will trust you as they trust no other Northern man.
All I want to do is to remain here with you.
Oh.
If I go, I must go alone.
Have you no sense of duty? Only you can prevent a worldwide disaster.
I sense only that thoughts of this Evesham affair are robbing these days with you of half their brightness and rousing me only into dark meditations in the silence of the night. Now, let's shake off these morbid thoughts. Come, come. I'll race you down the mountain.
No,
she said, as if I jarred with her gravity. But I was resolved to end that gravity and made her run. No one can be very grave and sad who is out of breath. We ran down past a couple of men who turned back, staring in astonishment at my behavior. They must have recognized my face. And halfway down the slope came a tumult in the air. Those war things came flying, one behind the other. They had never fought. They were just like our ironclads are nowadays. They had never fought. No one knew what they might do with excited men inside them. Few even cared to speculate. No one could tell exactly what was going to happen. And meanwhile, I suppose it was very fine to go whirling through the air like a flight of young swallows, swift and easy. I guess the captains tried not to think too clearly what the real thing would be like. We didn't go into the city until the sky was full of stars. So we walked out upon the high terrace, to and fro, and she counseled me to go back.
My dearest, this is death. This life you lead is death. Go back to them. Go back to your duty. Go back. Go back.
No.
No.
Nothing shall send me back. Nothing.
Oh. No, I have chosen. Love, I have chosen, and the world must go. Whatever happens, I will live this life. I will live for you.
Nothing shall turn me aside. Nothing, my dear one.
Even if you died. Even if you died.
Yes.
Then I also would die.
And before she could speak again, I began to talk, talking eloquently, as I could do in that life, talking to exalt love, to make the life we were living seem heroic and glorious, and the thing I was deserting something hard and enormously ignoble, that it was a fine thing to set aside. I bent all my mind to throw that glamour upon it, seeking not only to convert her, but myself to that. We talked, and she clung to me, torn too between all that she deemed noble and all that she knew was sweet. And at last I did make it heroic, made all the thickening disaster of the world only a sort of glorious setting to our unparalleled love. And we two poor foolish souls strutted there at last, clad in that splendid delusion, drunken rather with that glorious delusion, under the still stars. And so my moment passed. It was my last chance. Even as we went to and fro there, the leaders of the South and East were gathering their resolve, and the hot answer that shattered Evesham's bluffing forever took shape and waited. And all over Asia and the ocean and the South, the air and the wires were throbbing with their warnings to prepare, prepare. No one living, you know, knew what war was. No one could imagine, with all these new inventions, what horror war might bring. I believe most people still believed it would be a matter of bright uniforms and shouting charges and triumphs, flags and bands, in a time when half the world drew its food supply from regions 10,000 miles away. After that, I dreamt often. For 3 weeks of nights, that dream was my life. And the worst of it was, there were nights when I could not dream, when I lay tossing on a bed in this accursed life. And there, somewhere lost to me, things were happening, momentous, terrible things. I lived at night. My days, my waking days, this life I am living now, became a faded, faraway dream, a drab setting. Cover of the book. I could tell you all, tell you every little thing in the dream. But as to what I did in the daytime, no. No, I could not tell. I do not remember. My memory has gone. The business of life slips from me.
And then?
The war burst like a hurricane.
And then?
One touch of unreality, and they would have been nightmares. But they were not nightmares. They were not nightmares. No. No.
going there. The club has been taken over by the military.
But I am Hedden.
That name means nothing to me. Who is she?
She's with me.
Why aren't either of you wearing your badges?
We have no badges.
No badges? Are you not for Egypt?
We are for ourselves.
You're no one. No one. Get away. Go back to your quarters and stay there. You're hindering the mobilization.
Hedden, my darling, what should we do?
We must get out of this place. I've made my choice and I have no hand in these troubles. We have nothing of this war. We have taken our lives out of all these things. This is no refuge for us. Let us go. And the next day, we were already in flight from the war that covered the world. All the rest was flight. All the rest was flight.
How much was there of it? How many days? Where did you go?
When?
When you left Capri.
Southwest. We went in a boat.
But I should have fought an airplane.
They'd been seized. But why should it be? If indeed this battle, this slaughter and stress is life, why have we this craving for pleasure and beauty? If there is no refuge, if there is no place of peace, and if all our dreams of quiet places are a folly and a snare, why have we such dreams? Surely it was no ignoble cravings, no base intentions that brought us to this. It was love that isolated us. Love to come to me with her eyes, robed in her beauty, more glorious than all else in life, in the very shape and color of life, and summoned me away. I had silenced all the voices, I had answered all the questions. I had come to her. And suddenly there was nothing but war and death.
After all, it could have been only a dream.
A dream. A dream? When even now we are but phantoms and the phantoms of phantoms, desires like cloud shadows and wills of straw that eddy in the wind. The days pass. Habit carries us through as a train carries the shadow of its lights. Well, so be it. But one thing is real and certain. One thing is no dream stuff, but eternal and enduring. It is the center of my life, and all other things about it are subordinate or altogether vain. I loved her. That woman of a dream. And she and I are dead together. A dream. Can it be a dream when it drenched a living life with unappeasable sorrow? When it makes all that I've lived for and cared for worthless and unmeaning? Until that very moment when she was killed, I believed we had still a chance of getting away. All through the night and morning that we sailed across the sea from Capri to Salerno, we talked of escape. We were full of hope. And it clung about us to the end. Hope for the life together we should lead out of it all, out of the battle and struggle, the wild and empty passions, the empty, arbitrary thou shalt and thou shalt not of the world. We were uplifted, as though our quest was a holy thing, as though love for one another was a mission. We had landed at Salerno, and we had been turned back from Calvary. And we had tried to cross towards Taranto by a pass over Mount Alburn. We'd been driven back for want of food. And so we had come down among the marshes by Piston, where those great temples stand alone. I had some vague idea that by Piston it might be possible to find a boat or something and take once more to the sea. And there it was. The battle overtook us. We were in an open place near those great temples at Piston, at last, on a blank, stony place dotted with spiky bushes, empty and desolate, and so flat that a grove of eucalyptus far away showed to the feet of its stems. Ah, how I can see it! My lady was sitting down under a bush, resting a little, for she was very weak and weary, and I was standing up, watching to see if I could tell the distance of the firing that came and went.
If we had parted, if I had let you go.
No, even now I do not repent. I will not repent. I made my choice.
and I will hold on to the end.
I carried her towards the temples in my arms, as though it mattered. I don't know why. They seemed a sort of sanctuary, you know. They had lasted so long, I suppose. She must have died almost instantly. Only I talked to her all the way. I sat down on a fallen pillar and held her in my arms, silent, after the first babble was over. And after a little while, the lizards came out and ran about again, as though nothing unusual was going on, as though nothing had changed.
Fraga! Maldor!
You mustn't come here. I am here. I am here with my dead.
Quabrasmendo?
I said don't come in here.
Fraga, vilo fraga!
Keep away!
Fraga! Maldor!
You must not come here. These are old temples, and I am here with my dead.
Fraca, Maldos!
You fool! Don't you know? She's dead. She's... He ran me through the heart. It was with a sort of astonishment. No fear, no pain. But just amazement that I felt it pierce me. Felt the sword drive home into my body. It didn't hurt, you know. It didn't hurt at all.
Do you mean?
There was no pain, no sting or smart. Amazement. And then darkness sweeping over everything. The hot, brutal face before me, the face of the man who had killed me, seemed to recede. It swept out of existence. A darkness. A flood of darkness that opened...
Houston! Houston,
and spread and blotted out all things.
Any luggage, sir?
And that was the end?
No.
You mean?
I couldn't get to her. She was there on the other side of the temple. And then...
Yes.
Nightmares. Nightmares indeed. Oh, my God. Great birds. That fought. And... tore.
You have been listening to Martin Jarvis in A Dream of Armageddon, based on a story by H.G. Wells. Heard in the cast were Melinda Peterson, Hamilton Camp, and Ira Burton.